From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On Story features discussions with a diverse array of voices who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival and Conference at our year-round events and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On today's episode, friends and Grace and Frankie co-creator Marta Kaufman.
We wanted our show to have warmth. We wanted these to be people that you wished you were friends with. You know, that you wanted to hang with and have a beer or a lasagna.
Followed by How I Met Your Mother co-creator Carter Bays.
We wanted to do a story about storytelling and about the way we live our lives and create our own story as we're living them.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Emmy and Golden Globe winning writer, producer, and showrunner Marta Kaufman got her big break in the early 1990s when she and her then writing partner David Crane created the first HBO original comedy, Dream On. The two went on to create the primetime network comedy institution, Friends. During its 10-year run from 1994 to 2004, Friends landed 63 Emmy nominations, winning Outstanding Comedy Series in 2002. One of Marta Kaufman's latest projects is the critically acclaimed Netflix original comedy, Grace and Frankie. The series features a dream team ensemble, top-lined by veteran actors Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Martin Sheen, and Sam Waterston. Barbara Morgan spoke with Marta Kaufman in 2016 at the 23rd Austin Film Festival, where we honored Marta Kaufman with AFF's Outstanding Television Writer Award. Clips in this half of our program copyright Warner Brothers Television, Bright Kaufman Crane Productions, and Skydance Productions, LLC.
David Crane and I met at Brandeis. At the time, we were both actors. We met doing a play. I played a street whore, and he played an urchin. And that's how we met, and we were both taking a class together, and someone offered me to direct a production of Godspell. The irony of that production is the guy who played the Jesus part is now a rabbi. And I said to David, would you be in it? And he said, no, but I'll direct it with you. And that's how we started. We were doing musical theater for many years in New York. This was in 1985, and an agent came in, and she said, why aren't you guys doing TV? And we went, And she, to this day, is my agent. Really? We got a deal with Norman Lear. That's what brought us out to Los Angeles. And we had also written Dream On while we were still in New York. We had written the pilot, and the woman who was running his company, she loved it. We were about to go to suspend and extend our contract with him, and we were about to go do Dream On. We were literally leaving that week. And the woman who ran the company walked in. She was ashen, and she said, Norman doesn't like it. We were like, okay. And then he came in later. We were in the kitchen, and he comes over to me, and he takes my hand in his, and he says, shallow. And he grabs David Crane by the shoulders, and he says, and superficial. And we went to do Dream On, and instead of having Marta Kaufman and David Crane on the door, we had Shallow and Superficial. We were HBO's first comedy. Universal had all these hours and half hours of TV that they didn't know what to do with. It's a huge library. And they had a million people come in and interview for the job of trying to turn it into a series. So when they scraped the bottom of the barrel and found these two musical theater writers, we talked about how we grew up on television and how much it influenced our lives, so that's where it started. And when we first pitched it, we had to pitch to John Landis, who was the executive producer. And at first, I was very uncomfortable with the idea of working with him, except that he really liked what we did. And he's actually a fascinating man. And he loved the idea. We wrote the pilot. And I actually don't remember pitching it to HBO, but obviously we must have, because they picked it up. And we did, I think it was 6 seasons.
Wow. So you had that run of that show, which was probably a very different experience, certainly at that time. And then you go into this network program that had to have been a much different build-up than doing Dream On. So can you talk about how Friends actually was birthed?
When we went to pitch Friends, I remember David and I sitting around talking about what kind of series we wanted to do, and we were in a group of 6 people in New York. We were all we had. We were all there by ourselves. 4 of the 6 turned out to be gay, and we are actually all still quite close after all these years. You know, this was our group. And what we had talked about is that basically it's about that time in your life when your friends are your family, because once you have your own family, things change. And I remember driving down the street in LA and seeing a place called Insomnia Cafe. And that really grabbed me, the idea of that, the idea of a place where people are up all night drinking coffee. So that's kind of, that was one of the things that birthed the idea of Central Perk. And honestly, I feel like the stars were aligned, everything was right, because that pilot wrote itself in 3 days. You know, we just sort of got out of the way and let it go. And then the rest was just magic.
So what was going on in the television world right around the time that you, because that started in 94, right?
Yeah.
So what was that world like for other shows that were in the same zone as you? And I'm sure the whole ramp up of whether your show was going to make it past the first season, et cetera. How were you prepping for the life of your show compared to the other?
You don't. Seinfeld was on. That was the closest comparison, but we've always said they don't hug on Seinfeld. We wanted our show to have warmth. We wanted these to be people that you wished you were friends with, you know, that you wanted to hang with and have a beer or a lasagna. We weren't, at the time, like anything else on TV, and I recall that after the first, I think, 3 episodes, we jumped into the top 10, and then within a season, we were in the top 5. So it was a pretty quick success with the audience. After we did that first season, suddenly everybody's trying to do shows about groups of young people. And I kept saying, it makes no sense, because TV is not a formula. You have to be lucky and hit the right feeling at the right time. After 9/11, one of the things that we saw happen is that people flocked to Friends because it was comfort. And I like the idea that we do comfort TV, that it's, you know, there are plenty of beautiful shows. Comfort is not what they offer. If anything, they make you uncomfortable, and that's part of what they're trying to do, and that's great, but that's not what I do. And that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to do something where we wanted to hang out with us. And the other thing we kept saying to ourselves, we want to do something that we would watch. Mm-hmm. Each of the characters has a piece of me or David. He's got a lot of both Chandler and Ross in him. Yes, I'm the person who wants to close the marker until it clicks. But I also have the little bit of the Phoebe spirity thing. And I was raised probably to be like Rachel. And basically it came from us sitting around, and we weren't even talking about us, but you're always part of the character because you're writing it. But we were talking about David's cousin and, you know, people we knew. And they just sort of slowly, as we talked about them, the ones that made us laugh, the ones that felt like we could wrap our minds around those characters. Like, I understood Monica, the mother hen. I got that. I got the woman who's at the center of it. But she was a little different when we started. She was a little tougher. So it's really, you're inspired by people you know. You're inspired by things about yourself that you either think are funny or neurotic or just, you know, I'd love to see someone else do that instead of me. And then the actor brings new breath to it, you know?
Are there some episodes out of that first season that you really feel like set a tone for the direction it was going to take for the next 10 years. I mean, you obviously you're not thinking at this point that you're going to be on 10 years, but, you know, surely you have a thought of where your show is ultimately going to go before you started it, or maybe not.
Nope. No, and fortunately, Friends is not lost, where you would hope that there was a place that you're landing. We didn't have to do all those twists and turns. You create characters, you put them in a situation, you create relationships, and then you see what happens. And you don't know. You don't know until an actor comes and breathes life into the character who's got chemistry. You don't know. We didn't know that Matt LeBlanc was really funny playing dumb. We had no idea that Joey was dumb.
Hey, Joey, what would you do if you were omnipotent?
Probably kill myself.
Excuse me?
Hey, if little Joey's dead, then I got no reason to live.
Joey, omnipotent.
You are?
And he was really good at it and really, really funny at it. So, you know, that changes things as you go on. Story-wise, all we really had a sense of was that season. And at that point, we only had, I think originally it was, 13 episodes, the first order. And it wasn't until we were, like, at episode 10 that they said, all right, you have more episodes. So you can't really plan for the end of the season because you don't know what they're going to tell you.
Who came up with the one about? And did that not get confusing over time?
No, it never did. I was actually talking to someone yesterday who said he was on set for one of them. I said, which one? And he goes, it's the one with... And that's why we did it, because that's how... Did you see the one where... So the hardest part was picking the story that if we said it, you'd remember which episode it was. You know, the one with the lesbian wedding, you get. The one with the prom video, you get. You know, the one with the pretzel, you won't get.
Well, so the first season, did you have any big battles with the network to try to keep it the way you wanted to keep it? Did they try to shift that comfort zone that you built, building?
One of the things they really wanted was an older character in the coffee shop, the coffee house, like we called him Pat the Cop. You know, some older person that they could get advice from. And we refused. That was one of the times we just said, absolutely not. We believed that if the stories are universal, people will watch. And they did. I mean, we got to prove them wrong on that. I was telling the story last night. In the pilot, Monica sleeps with someone who slips her a line.
What were you going to say?
Well, ever since she left me, I haven't been able to perform sexually.
And the head of the network felt that she deserved the treatment she got because she slept with a guy on her first date.
Of course it was a line!
Why? Why would anybody do something like that?
I assume we're looking for an answer more sophisticated than to get you into bed.
But once we got to about fourth season, besides the fact that things got really reactionary politically, we got to the point where after a table read, the network would turn to us and say, what do you think? Because we were much harder on ourselves than they were on us.
Austin Film Festival's On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with writer, producer, and showrunner Marta Kaufman speaking with Barbara Morgan at the 23rd Austin Film Festival in 2016.
How big a writer's room did you have, and how was that? Was it a fairly continuous writer's room over time? Or
we ended up, including me and David, with 14. And it's really fun, even at 3 in the morning. I once walked in. We were doing a rewrite after we had shot a show. And I stepped out to use the bathroom. And I walk back in. And that night, I was the only woman in the room. And I walk back in, I sit down, and we're, you know, talking about stuff. And all of a sudden, one by one, the guys stand up and stretch. And they've all taken their pants off. So we had fun. We also had this thing that we always needed some way to cope. And every year it changed. It started with, we had a box of liqueur-filled chocolates. And someone bet one of the writers that he couldn't eat them all by the end of the rewrite. As the season went on, by the end, one guy ate a 5-pound can of pork and beans.
Now we see where the episodes came from. I want to actually bring up a couple of things that I want you to refer to, some scenes you're particularly proud of, out of Friends, and I think we could probably go on for days on that, but where you really felt like you created some even deeper, richer things within the relationship amongst those characters that you just were surprised that they went there. And whether it's funny or sentimental, and I have to say, the Thanksgiving episode, when you brought up Joey's funny. Yeah. Where he does this thing with his eyes and his all their face. I mean, there's such great visual gags in there. Like, how did you talk about some of those moments?
Well, let's talk about Joey with the turkey on his head.
Hey, did you get the turkey baby? Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Who is that?
It's Joey.
What are you doing? Is this supposed to be funny?
No, it's not supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be scary.
Get that off now.
I can't. It's stuck.
Well, I don't care. That turkey has to feed 20 people at my parents' house, and they're not going to eat it off your head.
Right. Hold on, okay? Let's just all think.
Okay, I got it. Phoebe? All right. You pull. I'm going to spread the legs as wide as I can. Joey, yeah. Now is not the time.
Sorry, guys. Okay.
That's quite a visual. In terms of the first half of your question, there were things like in the prom video episode, at the very end of that episode, when Rachel, she crosses the entire apartment and goes over to Ross and kisses him. We knew people were invested in that relationship, but we had no idea how invested they were. And it got such an uproar from the audience. That was surprising and thrilling. Even more surprising was when we discover Monica and Chandler in bed.
Morning, Ross.
I'm getting married today!
Yeah, you are!
Oh, woo-hoo!
You think you knew I was here?
We thought it was just going to be a really funny, uncomfortable thing for the two of them, and it would be really awkward, and what it would do to the six of them. We had to stop because people were screaming so much in London. Screaming. We literally had to stop and wait. That was surprising. I think it always felt so good when things were emotional and funny at the same time. You know, people talk about we were on a break. That was a really, I mean, that happens to people. I love the birth episodes myself. I used to get so emotional every time I saw Phoebe with the triplets and she's talking to them and telling them that she's gonna, you know.
So here you are. Seems like yesterday I was talking to you in that little petri dish. Everyone said labor was the hardest thing I'd ever have to do, but they were wrong. This is. Well, I had the most fun with you guys. And I wish I could take you home and see you every day, but... Okay, I'll settle for being your favorite aunt. I know Alice's sister has a pool, but you lived in me.
That killed me. I also, one of my favorite things in the world, and I don't know why, I loved Ross and Susan in the closet when Carol is giving birth. Because I think they have a really interesting argument where he basically says, every day is lesbian mother day.
This is supposed to be like the greatest day of my life. You know, my son is being born and I should be in there. You know, instead I'm stuck in a closet with you.
The woman I love is having a baby today. I've been waiting for this just as much as you have.
No, no, no. Believe me, no one has been waiting for this as much as I have, okay? And you know what the funny thing is? When this day is over, you get to go home with the baby, okay? Where does that leave me?
You get to be the baby's father. Oh. Everyone knows who you are. And who am I? There's Father's Day, there's Mother's Day. There's no lesbian lover day.
Every day is lesbian lover day.
You know, this is dealing with real hurt that he was feeling, and it was funny and it was emotional, and that's my favorite stuff to write, when it's funny and it's emotional. We watched the first and last episode last night, and I was really surprised how I got a little, you know, verklempt. I did. So there were all those moments over the years that just surprised me, the ones that were more moving than we expected them to be. Those. There is, when Joey moves out for that brief period of time, and he and Chandler, you know, Joey's looking, it looks like he's looking through a, with rain, and it's just that little sculpture, and Chandler's playing ping pong with himself, and as funny as it was actually really sweet, because you knew this was coming from a place of how much they love each other.
Was there a freedom, or was it more constricting actually to have such a big ensemble cast?
Actually, I think it was, what was difficult was having to do three stories, and we had made a commitment to that, and that made it hard unless they were all doing one story. In some ways it made it easier because you had this beautiful well of possibilities. We had a deep bench, you know. We could go anywhere with these people. So I think it really, really helped. The constrictions had more to do with, you've got 21 minutes to tell a story in a teaser, three acts, and a tag. And that's what was difficult, that you have to sort of shoehorn your story into this format.
So I'm going to, because you've moved also into another sort of ensemble cast too now with Grace and Frankie. Can you talk about how that project came about?
There was a woman I had taken a trip with who I'd met on this trip, and she was lovely. And we said, we should work together sometime. We had lunch, and she said to me that Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda want to do TV. I thought she meant together. So I called that same agent, and I said, I hear Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda want to do a TV show together. And she said, I don't know, I'll call you right back. 20 minutes later, she called me back, and she said, they do now. So now we had to come up with something. I should just say, I'm going to take a little pause for a second. My producing partner, Robbie Tolan, and Hannah Cantor are part of the spine of this show. Hannah and I were sitting in the car, trying to come up with ideas, and I had had an idea, and this is before Transparent was on the air, that Jane's character would be married to a man and they get divorced and she comes back as Lily. But Transparent was happening, and Hannah came up with the idea that their husbands, that they're not, they don't like each other, their husbands fall in love and get married.
Who is she?
Oh, it's not what you think. It's a he.
Excuse me?
And it's Saul. I'm in love with Saul. Saul and I are in love.
My Saul?
Your Saul.
You mean you're gay? And this is who you're gay with?
This is who I'm in love with.
God. No, this makes no sense. You're business partners. You're not lovers. Friends. How long has this been going on?
Well, it's been, I don't know exactly, 20 years.
So that was her idea. After that, we started working with Jane and Lily and, you know, sort of pitching it to them and getting their input. And once we had a formed idea, we pitched it everywhere. We got very lucky to get more than one offer, but we also felt strongly that Netflix was the place. After you write the first episode, they don't call it a pilot. They call it a first episode. If they like the script, you go straight to 13 episodes. You go right into production. You don't have to do a pilot, shoot the pilot, and wait 2 years till HBO can make a decision. And truthfully, considering the ages of our actors, we didn't have 2 years to wait. The idea of going straight to 13 is fascinating because it was so exciting. We're going to, yay. But you don't have a pilot to make mistakes. You don't, the learning curve happens while you're in production, which I have to say is, it's like being on the scariest roller coaster in the whole world because you just don't know. And we sort of hit our stride, I think, after the fourth or fifth episode, started to get a sense of where the line between comedy and drama is. And part of that was, again, being their first self-produced comedy. They kept saying, more drama, more drama, more drama. And then they, at one point, went, you know what, you can make it funnier. I mean, we always meant for it to be real and deal with real things. I mean, the big surprise has been that the audience has a much wider age range than they ever expected, than we ever expected.
And why do you think that is?
My hope is that it's like Friends, you know, that it's universal stories. It's about starting your life over. Who doesn't want to think about starting their lives over if you're in a bad place? I also think, we've talked about this, there was a review that called it, and I don't read reviews, so Hannah reads them to me if I'm scared. There was one review that called it comfort food, sort of not unlike the way people feel watching Friends, that it's comfortable, it's easy, it's not going to ask you to have insomnia afterwards because you're feeling yucky about people. It's a much warmer, again, it's warmer, and I think that's partly why. Part of it is absolutely Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Martin and Sam, and June and Brooklyn, I believe, brought a younger audience, and they just stuck with it. I mean, I was shocked that people in their 20s were watching it and enjoying it. And I think especially for women, they're going, I will be there one day.
You want to talk a little bit about your casting process, because obviously in Friends, I mean, those were people who were not known to the world at that point, for the most part. And now you're working in a space where most of the people you do know, except the secondary part of that cast, are most people that I didn't recognize either. And you seem to have a Midas touch with casting. So can you talk about how you put, even with Dream On, I mean, he was perfect. So how do you go about, did your theater background help you figure out how to cast these shows? And how much did you have to do with that? How much did people you brought on help you?
It has to start with the casting director. This person is going to bring to you people. The hope is that the casting director shares the vision you have. And again, that's very often a relationship that has to develop. Tracy Lillianfield, who does our casting, she did Dream On, so we had a relationship. So that's part of it. I think actually what has helped in casting more than anything is that I was an actor for a period of time. I love actors. When I write, I think like an actor. I have to think about, could I, even as a lousy actor, make that transition? Could I go from here to there? Does it make sense? How do I get there? Why am I crossing the room? So I think that's what helps the casting process, just because you have this a gut feeling if it's real or not. So Jane and Lily were a given, at which point we're like, oh my God, we have Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. That was just crazy. And then when we started casting the men, that was actually a much trickier process because Netflix had some strong opinions, and we knew it was going to be offer only because they love having names. And I mean, come on, look who we got, Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston. They're ridiculous. And they're the nicest people, and these four are pros. They come in, they are prepared, they are on time, they know their lines when they can remember them. They have good actor questions. They are observant. Jane Fonda, when we were doing the pilot, this knocked my socks off. We were shooting in a grocery store, and her product, the character's products, were on a shelf. And before we shot, she calls me over, and I was like, uh-oh. She calls me over, and she points to the shelf of products, and she says, they're too expensive. She was right. It never occurred to me even to look at the prices. So the four of them deeply understand their characters. They all work very differently. Martin can, you know, he can be laughing and talking one minute and telling stories and eating rice and the next minute cry. Jane works from the inside out. Lily loves her props and her wigs and sort of needs those things to affect her character. Sam is... He comes in with a performance. They work hard. And, you know, I worked with six young people who, honestly, they got success very quickly and didn't have to work for the pros and understand exactly what it is to be a pro. I mean, they were great. They worked very hard, but they also ate peanut butter toast during a run-through, you know. Look, it's not the worst thing that could happen. We had no divas. We didn't have any of that craziness. But I have had that experience on other shows where we had young people who were awful and felt entitled. And then I look at these four who've had these extraordinary careers, and they are kind, and they work hard, and they are gracious. And I think everybody should work with people like that. Yeah.
So when you got that first season out of the way and you learned some lessons in those first four or five episodes, how did that change, shift how you're looking at it now for the future of the show?
The concept for the show gave us, without question, a very clear first season. And then it gave us a pretty good roadmap for the second season. But the concept kind of plays out. So now it has to be about, really, what does it mean to start your life over at a certain age? Really, what does that mean? What does it mean when you're in your 70s and your body isn't what it used to be, not in terms of beauty, because, let's face it, Jane Fonda looks better than I ever have. What happens when your body starts to reject the things you want to do? We love that arena, but it doesn't give you an arc, because Netflix doesn't like an episodic feel. They want one thing to lead to another, to lead to another, to lead to another. They call them chapters rather than episodes. So that's the challenge now, is to find the fabulous way to tell stories that don't have to do with their being divorced.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Carter Bays is best known with his writing partner, Craig Thomas, as the co-creator and showrunner of the CBS sitcom, How I Met Your Mother. The series stars Josh Radnor, Jason Segel, Colby Smulders, Neil Patrick Harris, Allison Hannigan, and Christine Milioti. How I Met Your Mother was nominated for 28 Emmy Awards in its 9-season run. In that time, the show took home 9 Emmys, 2 Golden Globes, and a total of 72 award nominations. How I Met Your Mother concluded in 2014 with a total of 208 episodes. Literary agent Becca Oliver spoke with Carter Bays in 2016 at the 23rd Austin Film Festival. Clips in the following segment, copyright 20th Century Fox Film Corporation and Fox Film Music Corp.
Craig and I, when we created How I Met Your Mother, we were coming out of working on American Dad, which was sort of our first experience with animation. And we had so much fun writing for that show, and especially just being unbound by the constraints of sets. You know, you could write a show with 71 scenes and, you know, with 71 different sets, and you could get away with it. So when we had the idea for How I Met Your Mother, I think we were just in that mindset of just not being constrained by any kind of production rules whatsoever. And we wrote a script that had, I think, 71, 72 scenes, I think, in the pilot, which was totally unproducible for a 4-camera sitcom, like for a multicam, like that you could not shoot it in one night. We did a table read, and the table read went great, but then we did the run-through, which is where all the sets are built, and like all the executives and all the writers go down to the stage, and the actors perform a scene on the set. They just perform the whole scene, and then everyone just gets up and everyone moves and goes over to the next set where the next scene takes place. And you go to that set, and they perform that scene. And usually, you know, that takes about the length of a TV show, maybe a little longer for walking. How I Met Your Mother, with 71 scenes, I mean, you needed hiking boots to do this run through. I mean, you've seen the show, like so many of the scenes are like, then what'd you do? You know, that's the whole scene. It's just like you cut back to the bar, what happened next? Cut back to the date. We just realized very quickly that this, if we tried to shoot this in one night, it would be a 30-hour shoot, and the audience would revolt probably. So we made the decision then to shoot it as a hybrid, which people weren't really doing. I mean, it's basically a multicam show with a laugh track, but without an audience. So we didn't have an audience, which gave us more space on the stage to build more sets. Standard multicams, you shoot it in one night. You got your big show night, and the audience is there, and it's got all the energy, and you just get it in one take, and you move on. And with a single cam, it's 5 days of shooting, and every light is hung just so, and every moment is nuanced just so, and then you shoot the whole thing, and then you turn around and shoot the whole thing again, and it takes forever. And our show was this really just purely by practicality sort of became a hybrid of those two. And we would shoot our episodes in 3 days. And it helped the show in so many sort of ineffable ways that we didn't anticipate. I think it let us make what felt like a single camera show, but with a kind of a raucous energy that's kind of felt like really fast. And so it'd be like we'd get it in a couple takes and then we'd move on, which kind of gave it that fun energy. You want to get it quickly and move on, because that's I think that's where a lot of comedy comes from, is that energy. But at the same time, we could slow down. And if there was a scene that was, for instance, there's that scene of Ted's big speech to Robin on the street where he's like, just lays himself bare.
I'm in love with her, okay? If you're looking for the word that means caring about someone beyond all rationality and wanting them to have everything they want, no matter how much it destroys you, it's love. And when you love someone, you don't stop, ever. Even when people roll their eyes or call you crazy, even then, especially then, you don't give up. Because if I could give up, if I could just, you know, take the whole world's advice and move on and find someone else, that wouldn't be love. That would be some other disposable thing that is not worth fighting for. But that is not what this is.
If we were doing that in front of an audience, like I think Josh Radnor will tell you, I don't think he had the emotional resilience to do that more than one or two times. Like, it was like a really emotional, cathartic scene for him to do. It was very, and he played it so honestly and beautifully. And I think we couldn't have gotten that kind of performance if there were 600 people standing, watching him, waiting for someone to call cut so they come out with a t-shirt cannon again. It kind of created a good, like, a good balance between those two things. It was, we knew the story we wanted to tell. We knew the way we wanted to tell it in this kind of extended flashback. And we knew that, I mean, there was a little bit of preciousness of as far as, like, we wanted to try doing, like, flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks. And that was fun to, it was fun to create that. Like, in the pilot episode, there's that moment where he says, I love you, and you get his friend saying, what? And you get the kid saying, what?
I think I like your nose.
I think I'm in love with you.
What? What?
What?
So that was a little, like, being formally playful, but for the most part, that it was about the story. It was about, we wanted to do a story about storytelling and about the way we live our lives and create our own story as we're living them. And it was not the most standard traditional idea for a sitcom. It had traditional elements, which I think helped sell it, but it was definitely, the things we were clinging to were things that made it not an obvious choice for a show.
I want to talk about one of my favorites, which is the slap bet.
Ugh,
and
yeah.
What a genius. So, first of all, please tell us that you have actually been involved in the slap bet.
Many slap bets. In high school, that was, my friend John Reed and I would make slap bets with each other. And it was, I mean, it's just the most exciting thing in the world. When there's going to be a slap, like, that's a real thing. That's like,
that brings joy to viewers, that slap.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
I loved it. So talking about that, because I envisioned a spreadsheet where you're like, all right, here's the first slap.
Completely.
And then here's the second slap. But then also specifically talking about my favorite slap bet related episode, which is, of course, Slapsgiving, which we all think about around this time of year.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So using that slap bet, talk a little bit about how you plot out that really satisfying thing for dedicated fans.
That was a very fun. Was that the first episode with Chris Elliott, or was that Slapsgiving 2?
That's the second
maybe
one.
That was the second one. Okay,
yeah,
I confused those two. All I remember about the writing of that was it was seven people sitting around a conference room table, like, just looking at the ceiling, trying to think of words that start with AP. So it'd be like slaplication. Slap-O-Matic's courthouse, that was 90% of the writing of it was silly puns that Marshall could use to torment Barney.
Wait, Marshall, you realize you only have one left after this. Are you sure you want to spend the slap today?
No, life is short. I figured slap ad diem.
And that episode ends with a song from Marshall.
Oh, right? Yeah. That was
who wrote that song?
I wrote that song. I wrote it I went to a friend's wedding in Martha's Vineyard, and it was a beautiful wedding and a beautiful weekend, and I spent the whole time just humming that to myself, like, you just got slapped.
You feel the blood rush to your cheek. Tears start to fill your eyes. And your lips are trembling, but you can't speak. You're trying not to cry.
Craig and I are frustrated musicians and just wanted, like, an excuse to write music. Like, as far as, like, the whole, like, you know, who's more excited about it thing, like, anytime one of us would say, like, maybe this person could sing a song, it would be like, yes. And we would just, like, drop everything and abandon all of our more important work to go grab our guitars and write a song. And Jason immediately loved it. And we had that piano there on the set, which was like, we knew, like we're going to use this piano at some point. And that's when we finally used it.
So let's talk a little bit about real life stories making their way into How I Met Your Mother. I guess I asked that because I read that you, when the show started, you identified with Ted. And then as it progressed, you identified more as a married man with Marshall and Lily, and even Ted and the mother, Tracy, at the end. So talk about how in that writing room and in your own life, those stories from your life make their way into the show.
Especially Ted's stuff was very autobiographical. At the beginning, like that his big speech was really me writing about my life at that time. And I think a lot of the lessons Ted learned over the course of the series were things that I learned. Like, it was definitely, as I, you know, transitioned from being Ted to Marshall, with maybe some Barney time in between, very quickly we sort of, the characters took lives of their own. I mean, There were, like, a few people that were inspirations for Barney, like some friends of ours from New York, two different guys, but they were both kind of, like, had qualities that sort of we drew from, but so much of it was Neil. I mean, Neil, like, the whole magic thing, that's just Neil. And like, the suit thing, too, like, that was invented whole cloth, but Neil just, like, just made that, like, as soon as he put on the suit and was like, it sort of like, we realized like, yeah, this is who this character is. And I think with all of them, like, Marshall was initially, Craig had back then a bit of a hypochondriac streak, and he's gotten better about it, I think he'll tell you. But like, so in the pilot, in the first draft of the pilot, there's this whole story about Marshall being a hypochondriac, about him thinking he has cancer or something. And it was very, this very kind of silly B story that ended up, you know, not making it into the show. And I think part of what made it not make it into the show was we cast Jason Segel, who is the most confident human being on earth and the most like indestructible human. I mean, he just like, it didn't play right with him. Like, he just doesn't seem like a guy who's and that, I think, unlocked this side of Marshall that made him so much more fun, of this guy who's just absolute confidence. He's married, he's settled down, he's happy, and he can sort of look at the shenanigans of these single people and just laugh about it and have a good time. And that I think Jason brought that to that character. And I think with all the characters, that it Kobe being Canadian, like, that was a thing that, you know, as soon as we heard Kobe was Canadian, we made Robin Canadian. And so very quickly, they became amalgamations of us and of the actors. And then as we brought in more writers, like, the writers brought things, and ultimately it was a fun way to build those characters, I think, just kind of drawing from real life.
Well, and such a great part of the show is that you have these five characters that if you just read one sentence about them on the page, they're stock characters. The guy who loves to chase the ladies around New York and will be a bachelor forever, and the bachelor who desperately wants to meet the woman, but they became so much more. And did you know as you were starting at that pilot, at that moment with the pilot, that they were going to evolve the way that they did?
Pilots are very hard. It's very hard to sell a character in three lines. And it sometimes archetypes can be your friends. I mean, like, it really was for this show to like get picked up and to like get it immediately, like, you really needed to just hit the idea of like, Ted is this nice guy and he's got a devil and an angel on his shoulder, and Barney's the devil and Marshall's the angel, and we just drove towards that as hard as we could in the first few episodes, but with the understanding that, like, while we can play this particular melody, like, we had to do themes on the melody, and we had to sort of decorate the tree with as many interesting ornaments as we could to help fill out the characters. And it was something we felt out with every passing episode, you know, as we would find out more and more about the characters. I think we were very, very conscious of, like, we don't want to do the thing where, like, this character is one way in season one and then they're just someone totally different in season three. So we really, like, we're very conscious about, like, let's not go too big with our, like, declarations about the characters. And but at the same time, so that was kind of the idea.
Well, even with Marshall and Lily, that you sort of break all of our hearts by having Lily break up with Marshall, but then you don't make us wait too long for them to get back together because they're meant to be together.
Yeah.
That story arc, the two of them, is pretty, is to me the heart of the show.
We knew that's where season one was going to end. It's sort of the point of the whole show is that, like, no matter how awful something seems in the moment, you're going to be, there's a version of you 30 years from now that can laugh about it.
So I have a 13-year-old friend who is a super fan of How I Met Your Mother, and he had a lot of questions for you, actually.
Okay, but listen,
I'm gonna ask, what is Barney's job? What does Barney do for a living? Tell us about that.
Oh my God, that was Chris Harris was a writer on the show the whole run of the show, and we created the Goodwin Games with him. Going into season 9, we had this list of, like, what are the mysteries we haven't solved, and let's solve them. Where's the pineapple? Where's, you know? When we got to the question of what does Barney do for a living, we were all, you know, we were stumped. Like, how can you pay this off after 9 years? Like, it's got to be something great. And, like, you know, is he a spy? Is he da 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 da? And nothing felt right. And Chris had this great moment. He just, like, suddenly stood up, just kind of paced around, just thinking for a second, and then, like, went to the board and just wrote P-L-E-S, you know, wrote please. Just the idea that please is an acronym was, like, this amazing, like, okay, it's going on the show. We're done. We got it. You know, it was a great moment in TV writing.
Did you find yourself approaching those last couple episodes and you did have that long list and you were sort of forcing, how are we going to tie all of this together in a nice little bow?
Yeah, I mean, that made season 9 such a pleasure because there were so many things. Like, every week there was something. That's satisfying. I mean, like, that How Your Mother Met Me episode was that times a million. That was, like, made 9 years of doing the show worthwhile, just to be able to do that episode. It felt like everything that came up to that was just backstory for this episode. You know, we were shooting at the beach, and Robin and Ted are watching the sunrise, and he asks her, did you want me to kiss you that night? And she says yes. And like, just knowing that like we had set that in the pilot. I mean, the whole ninth season, making it was just like constantly hugging all the time. Just because there was just moment after moment of that, of like just kind of this like resolution to things.
I'm guessing that you and Craig never get asked about the ending of How
Not
I
really.
Met Your Mother.
Did it end? Is it still going? I feel like it's still going.
But we can't have a conversation with the Carter Bays without talking about the ending.
Oh,
so
boy.
It's been said in interviews, you guys have said that you knew when it started how it was going to end. And I'm assuming that's true.
It was probably the end of season one, I think, when we actually didn't know. We didn't know when we shot the pilot. Like, the problem of season one was Ted and Robin are so great together. How will anyone ever surpass Ted and Robin? And we didn't realize that 9 years later that could actually happen. But it was at the end of that season that we sort of, in talking about it, kind of came upon what if this is the reason he's telling this whole story? What if this whole story is about him actually sitting these kids down to explain to them this next step that he's going to make in life?
So then knowing that, I would imagine it feels pretty good. You have a target. You know what you're moving towards. You're not feeling super rudderless as you go into seasons. But at the same time, I can't imagine there aren't a number of challenges that come with that as well as the story progresses. So can you talk about some of those moments when you realized, oh, it kind of sucks that we know how this is ending?
That was one where just the story led us there. It led us to, you know, at one point, I swear to God, the idea was going to be that you'd never see the mom, which that would have been, I think, even worse in a lot of ways. But it really, like, you know, when it was between, like, do a season nine or not, and we chose to do a season nine, 10% creatively driven, but 90%, like, we just love all of our coworkers, and we love this job. We never want it to end. And, yeah, part of, you know, initially season eight would have been the end of the series, and the finale of season eight would have been, you know, yeah, I think you never see, I think we were talking about you never see her at all. And then we decided, all right, we're doing season nine. We can't, like, we have to make it exciting to ourselves. And we were really, like, that was kind of, I say, like, 90% driven by wanting to keep the show going. But it was, like, creatively, like, we had to have some reason. There had to be some exciting reason to do another season. And I think Craig had the idea of, like, let's meet the mom. Let's get to know her this season. And I'm so glad we did it for that reason. I think working with her was incredible, and she was incredible, and she was worth the wait, I think.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.